and Human Services Budget Reform to order. Today is Tuesday, April 8th. We are continuing with our informational format, but before I get into that, I'll ask Mr. Berkovian if he has any announcements.
Thank you, Representative Westland. Just one at your at the dais is a copy of an email. It's a response from the people from Mercer yesterday to a question that Representative March asked about the state of Connecticut being ordered to stop reductions in cuts to their some of their SCHIP recipients. So copies that is in front of you, and there's some extra out on the table.
Well, I give Mr. Schramm my marks for getting back to us in an expeditious fashion
very,
on that.
Very prompt.
Anything else?
Not fit.
Very good. As I indicated, we're continuing with our informational format, invited testimony only. So let me call up some of our friends from the fully capitated health plan prescription drug or with information on their prescription drug management program. Pat Gift. She's only from my hometown. It's okay. The Gifford, Colleen Cordes, and Chris Kirk. Enter and sign in, please.
She's from Tumalo.
Well, close enough to my hometown. We're friendly over there. Actually, my hometown is Long Beach, but... Are we short one?
Yes, we are.
Chris Kirk?
I'm Chris Kirk.
You're Chris Kirk?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I apologize. Colleen Cordes, the pharmacist who is listed on the agenda, was unable to attend. She injured her back, and her physician suggested that 6 hours in the car wasn't the best thing for her. For the record, my name is Patricia Gifford. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Central Oregon Independent Health Services. We're a rural, fully capitated health plan. We serve 11 counties east of the Cascades, from the Columbia Gorge down into Lakeview out to Burns. We cover about 50,000 square miles. I have in front of you a packet of information.
Pat, if I could ask you to get just a little friendlier with that mic.
Okay. I forget, these are the non-sensitive ones.
Right. This might be a historic room, but it's technologically antiquated.
Okay. Is this better?
Right. Yeah, that's great.
Okay. There's quite an extensive packet in front of you. Rest assured, I'm not going to go through it in detail. A lot of it's supporting documentation for our presentation. In the beginning, there's an overview of our plan. I think we're unique in that we're the largest Oregon health plan in a rural area, but we also have 8 A and B hospitals under contract, which is a distinct challenge for us out of our 9 hospitals. In addition to being an Oregon Health Plan contractor, we also have a Medicare Plus Choice plan, and we serve about 1,386 dual eligibles who are both Medicare and Medicaid eligible in our service area. We also do commercial business. I think most importantly is sort of our ownership structure, provider relations. We are owned by the hospitals and the physicians within our service area, like many of the other fully capitated plans. And we provide a whole range of services to all of our members. We do our own claims processing. We do customer service, grievance and appeals, the whole gamut of services that's provided to these folks. We've been a contractor since 95. We were very small, and we started in Grant Lake and Wheeler counties, which was a total of 1,100 members. We expanded in 1996 to Crook, Deschutes, Jefferson, and Harney, and in 97 to Hood River, Wasco, and Sherman. We're currently serving the OHP Plus population only, which is about 17,000 folks. Most importantly in this discussion is our pharmacy program. And again, I apologize that our pharmacy director isn't here. If there are any fairly technical questions that I need to have her respond to, I will get those to you quickly. In the packet, I included for you all of the documentation that supports the development of our formulary and the process that we use for prescription drugs. And I guess a couple of points I'd like to make up front as we walk through this quickly is, first of all, this was a very thoughtful process. This wasn't let's pick the cheapest drug or a generic and say that's our formulary. physicians, pharmacists. Our QAUM committee, which is composed of local physicians, spent a great deal of time looking at the efficacy of the various drugs before moving forward with the formulary. And I've included the formulary development document in your packet so you can see the process that they went through. So the next point, I think, is management of the line, or management of the use of drugs for conditions that are covered under the benefit package. Pre-authorization of selected drugs. I've also included our pre-authorization list and the criteria for that pre-authorization list, as well as some financial information. Pharmacy pre-authorization accomplishes a number of things for us. In addition to tracking above and below the line conditions, it helps us with case management identification. Sometimes through the ordering of drugs, we can identify potential candidates for case management. It also helps with our formulary management, directing to preferred brands. It helps with alternative therapy. A formulary is less useful to a physician if you don't offer him or her an alternative to a drug that isn't on the formulary. It also helps with cost containment by managing to your formulary, but one of the things that we do effectively, I believe, is we can block drugs working with our pharmacy benefit manager either by class or by provider, which allows us to control some abuse situations, also to control some inappropriate prescribing situations that's necessary on occasion. Probably the most important slide, or most two important slides in your whole packet, is the one that's labeled CYS RX cost compliance. At the top, it shows that our drug costs per member per month for February of 2003 were a net $30.69 per member per month. That's rolled up all 19 eligibility categories, where it will vary from $5 per member per month for CHIP kids between 1 and 6 to $200 for some of the age-blind, disabled, more ill plus folks.
Question?
Representative Mona Sanders.
Tell me again what the 3069 means.
That is the average per member per month cost for our Oregon Health Plan membership. So when we look at our 17,000 folks, each one of them roughly costs us $30.69 per month in terms of drug costs. And like I mentioned, this is net. So this means this is not only the ingredient costs, which are $27.96, but it also includes pharmacy dispensing fees and claim costs, which are important components of the true cost of pharmacy that I sometimes think gets overlooked and is not thought of as part of the actual cost. Our formulary has a lot of generics on it.
Representative Greenland.
Just for clarification, that means that your dispensing fee is less than $2 a prescription?
That's correct. Hmm. On the next slide, it'll actually show you it's $1.85.
No. That's less than
$2.
That's low,
huh? Yes, it is.
Well, when we need it.
And our formulary compliance is 98%, which slightly there over. Rebates are low. Our average rebates for 2002 is 5%, and that is primarily because of it's formulary compliant and also the generic fill rate, which, as you are all well aware of, there isn't many rebates.
So that also means that over the course of, I guess this is this for February of 2003 or as of February 2003?
For February.
That means you had a 1.95% prior authorization utilization or prior authorization granted. If 98.5% of your drugs, I'm assuming that means you're off your formulary.
Correct.
Then 1.95.
We're non-formulary drugs.
We're non-formulary. So you went through your prior authorization process.
Correct. And these were exceptions to the formulary because of medical necessity.
Okay.
The next slide is it shows our contract with our PBM that's effective April 1. It shows you our average wholesale price is AWP minus 14%. For brand names, generic, it's the Medicare maximum allowable MAC, AWP minus 14, or usual and customary, whichever is less. Our dispensing fee, as Representative Greenlake pointed out, is $1.85. Our admin fee per claim, and this is the charge from our PBM to process the claim for each drug, is 25 cents. Below that is listed what our discount is for mail order, which we use for our members for chronic medications for management of disease. If it's less than 35 days, it's AWP minus 14. If it's over 35 or over 34, it's AWP minus 20. For brand name, for generic, it's AWP minus 55%. I think it's important that...
Representative Tomei.
Okay, I'm back on the previous page, and I apologize for being late. So the formulary compliance for non-formulary is 1.95%. What class of drugs would those be? Would they be mental health drugs, or is there a similarity among drugs that are...
Yeah, there are no mental health drugs in here. The plant mental health drugs are paid for by the state under fee-for-service, so these don't include mental health drugs. These are only the drugs that come through our plan. And they can be any class of drugs. It can be something that happens to be off our formulary for a condition where there may be a drug on the formulary, but for some reason it doesn't work for the patient. Right. So it's an exception that's made to a pre-authorization process.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sort of in summary, I think there's a couple of things that are very important to point out to the committee, and I think that there's been a lot of focus on rebates, and while rebates are important, I think the real cost savings in drug management comes from negotiating good contracts and actually managing the formulary. I think the fully capitated health plans have demonstrated and will demonstrate today that they have the ability and the expertise to effectively manage the drugs for the Oregon Health Plan population while continuing to provide a quality of care. I think effective formulary development has to be accomplished at a local level. It can't be something that's done at a very high level and then pushed down. Our process involved multiple physicians from multiple specialties from multiple communities who sat down, talked about what worked, what didn't work. We work with our pharmacy committee. Everybody works with the plan, and then consequently, everyone works with the patient. So we have a partnership where no one's unhappy about what the outcome is. There is an exception process for those people who do have problems. I think pharmacy benefit managers are critical. They're an important partner in this process, but they do not have the ability to manage drugs at the level that a plan does because they do not have those kinds of relationships with the providers and the plans and the patients. So I think it's a very important point.
Second, Pat. Rick?
Thank you, Chair. Pat, and you may be getting this later, is there an appeals? I mean, compliance is good. Is there an appeals process that you're required to follow that you have in place as a policy? If someone disagrees with the drug they might have received, they can request a reconsideration. And
yes.
Does that come up, and to what degree?
Yes, there is an appeals process if someone, you know, and usually it's the physician who will appeal, who will say, you know, the drug I need to prescribe for this patient for whatever reason isn't on the formulary. And sometimes it's as simple as a call to the medical director explaining the reason why it's overwritten and the prescription is given. If the physician feels that the patient should trial but the patient appeals, you know, there's also in a process that the patient can go through both internally and through OMAP to appeal a decision that they don't like. We get very few appeals. I think it's because of the involvement of the community in the development of the formulary process. If it's medical necessity and the medical director agrees, you know, it's a very simple process. It's a phone call.
And they're usually accepted.
Yes. Again, it's, you know, when someone calls, you know, a physician that they work with every day and says, I think this patient needs this because, and it has a reasonable, you know, reason to do it, it happens. It's not a big issue.
Please continue.
I've also included in the packet for you, like I mentioned, the formulary development document that we utilized in development of our formulary process. I apologize for the size of the font and the print. It's rather small. But it kind of outlines the process that we went through and shows you how we scored things both in terms of expense, efficacy, et cetera. I've also included for you, and Representative Westland has seen this before, is our formulary that we developed that shows you sort of how we have used some brand names and some generics, and as you can see, there's a combination. I'm not going to read it to you in detail, nor do I. Senator, Representative Bates may be more interested in it than the rest of you.
I really am.
I also provided our drugs who require pre-authorization, and some of these are on the formulary. But we try to manage the drugs both in terms of volume and also in terms of refills. So there is a list of formulary drugs that do require pre-authorization.
What does
is this on the formulary? Yeah, it's prior authorization required.
So those are above the line.
They're formulary drugs that require pre-authorization for some reason.
Okay, so you have in your formulary drugs that they have to get and then prior authorization for, and then there are drugs not on the list that they also have to get prior authorization for.
Correct.
Is it a different process? Or?
No.
Okay.
In general, we try to stick to the formulary. The exception process for a drug that's listed on the formulary comes about when the formulary drug doesn't work for the patient. So in general, we direct people to the formulary first. If there's a reason for an exception, then that's considered.
Okay. Mr. Chair, that's mm-hmm. interesting. But I also have noticed on page 2 of the formulary, you have a generic that requires prior authorization.
Which one?
Desmopressin,
whatever the world that is. I mean, why? And you may not know. I find that interesting because usually prior authorization is a cost savings sort of measure to try to make have them use cheaper drugs, and then there's a generic. I just found that interesting.
Perhaps I can shed some light.
For the record, Chris.
Chris Kirk, I'm the medical director for Mid-Valley IPA. It's an interesting situation in that desmopressin, which has been around for some time, is now produced generically, but not widely so because it has a very narrow indication for use. So it's still quite expensive. The other part of it is it's legitimate medical uses for people who have diabetes insipidus, not diabetes mellitus, but diabetes insipidus, and it causes them to produce massive amounts of urine that they can't control because they don't have this drug produced endogenously. By giving it, you can give them some normal bladder control. Unfortunately, it's become popular to give to children who have bedwetting problems. And it's, again, very expensive. And so the prior authorization process around this drug is to just make sure that it's used for a proper clinical indication.
So that's almost a combination of case management and formulary in the same authorization.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And also, as I mentioned before, we try to manage to things that are covered, and bedwetting is below the line. So there are reasons for pre-authorization.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bates. This is kind of a technical question. I'm just curious about it.
What question?
A technical question.
Oh, God.
You'll get over it.
I know this woman. Be nice.
I am. And actually, I'm going to be working for her soon, I hope. So I have to be nice to her for two reasons.
You think?
Yeah.
Okay.
Pat, I've never met
you. Check with me later, Pat.
I look forward to this for a long time.
Stay out of Jackson County. Whatever you do, stay out of Jackson County.
Please ignore him because we welcome you to Jackson County with your Medicare Choice Program. We've been asking it for 10 years, and I'm thankful you're bringing it to us. Thank you very much.
Welcome. This is the kind of stuff we put up with every day. Just ignore them.
Just forget these two yahoos to my left, okay? Stay with me. There's a class of drugs that you use for diabetes. Actos and Avandi are the two major ones. And I notice you have Actos on. It's pre-authorization. Avandi is not on. And I'll probably get killed walking through when I say this, but they're very similar drugs, similar outcomes. And you've chosen to have one on, one off, one with prior authorization. They're also very expensive and very effective.
Mm-hmm.
So did you make a choice there based on what was offered to you from a pharmaceutical point of view, working with pharma or working with the companies that made this? drug and say we're going to put one on and one not on? Was there a cost comparison? What was the decision process for that?
Well, I think the representative base, I think the decision process was multifaceted. I think it would probably all of those things were taken into consideration. As you say, they're very similar drugs. But I think probably when you work with a pharmacy benefit manager, clearly they have preferred drugs that will either bring you better rebates or lower costs. And I wasn't involved in that process. My guess is that was what made the choice between one and the other, was through our PBM.
Follow. So the PBM's role, I mean, because another thing I noticed in your situation was that you use a PBM, and yet you say a PBM doesn't fulfill the needs you have.
Exactly.
Because it has no relation between you and your physicians. So the PBM was probably involved in making some of these decisions of what makes onto the formulary and what doesn't.
To some degree, that's correct. What we did is sit down within our own group and made decisions about classes of drugs, and then went to the PBM to see which is the way to get the best price or the most substantial rebate when all other things being equal.
And if the company making Avandia decided that they wanted to get on your formulary, would they have some way of approaching you, or do they go through the PBM?
They would go through the PBM.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to apologize to Representatives March and Merkley for Representative Bates calling them Yeagers.
I was going to say that for the record, I was sure he was talking about Representatives Merkley and Anderson.
That me?
You're not. He was talking on the left.
On the left. Okay. There's only two on the left I worry about. You can figure it out yourselves.
You guys better be careful down there. Please continue, Pat.
Okay, I'll move through this rather quickly. There also is a list of medications. We have a selected pre-authorization list, and that is included as well. Also, I have given you the criteria for pre-authorization that we have developed to determine which drugs require pre-authorization. As Dr. Kirk mentioned, a lot of it is for making sure that the drug is used for the appropriate condition, as well as management of above and below the line and formulary compliance. The criteria tends to focus more on the clinical efficacy of the others. And I've also included at the end some specific things for a couple of conditions such as Crohn's disease and use of Remicade, which is a very expensive drug.
Mr. Bukovia. Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure you can answer this right off. I was kind of curious how perhaps your formulary or maybe even those of other health plans compare in terms of the drug classes that the state has now started to identify through its preferred drug list. I'm always curious if the evidence-based approach the state's using is somewhere in line with what some of the plans have found to be effective drugs. Do you have any feedback on that? Or
I can respond a little bit to that. I think that the plans' formularies are similar. I think there's some differences, but I think by and large the fully capitated health plans' formularies look somewhat alike. This has come about through a process, obviously, and most of them have gone through similar processes that we have in order to develop the pharmacy. Again, a preferred drug may be different because it's made by a different manufacturer who has a relationship with the PBM that they use. As how it compares to the state formulary development, the process that they're going through, I can't really address that. Perhaps Dr. Kirk can. That's it for me.
Any immediate questions for Pat? Chris?
Once again, Chris Kirk, I'm the medical director for Mid-Valley IPA, and I believe Jan Buffa has filled you in on our organization previously. I brought you today in your handouts a couple of articles that speak to controlling costs of pharmaceuticals and specifically address the two aspects of rebates that are available to state plans, and that as opposed to the management strategies that health plans typically use. If I could just briefly speak to how we go about pharmacy management, we
We started up as a health plan a little couple of years ago, and we had to create, we would have had to create things from scratch. We did have some experience. MVEPA had a previous medical director who had been there administering the OHP product by delegation for regions. I came from a past of moving from private practice to working for Humana, sitting on their P&T committee. From there, I went to United Healthcare and sat on their national P&T committee. Finally got back to the Northwest to work for Providence, where I sat on their P&T committee and administered the OHP plan when Providence was participating. Then when I moved to MVEPA, we were administering OHP under regions and also doing work for Providence and PacifiCare. While I was with Providence, I also was invited to sit on the LIPA P&T committee because they were one of our big providers, of course. So we sat down and began this process, and we decided not to hire a pharmacist. We put out RFPs for a PBM. We chose Advanced PCS for numerous reasons. Some of the key ones were that they had been the PBM that was administering the OHP pharmacy benefit for regions, so we hoped to have less of a switchover hassle factor. They also had the historical utilization data that was helpful to us. In creating that relationship, we have somewhat of a unique consulting role from a company called AEL. AEL is sort of a PBM watchdog. They have sort of a collegial adversarial role with PCS. Working for us, and it's their job to keep PCS honest. And indeed, we have actually found some situations where we were made aware of opportunities that we could contract for medications outside of the standard PCS formulary and took advantage of those through the efforts of AEL. As a sort of a part of PCS, they have also created a company called Specialty RX, which focuses on the very high-dollar medications. Many of these are injectable medications and are traditionally considered in the medical budget instead of the pharmacy budget. I don't know if you're aware of how that works, but if you go to a physician's office and get an injection, that cost actually gets added into the medical side of the budget rather than the pharmacy side. It's just an arbitrary way that things have always been done. But Specialty RX manages these very high-cost drugs, and they do two things. One is they go shopping for us for good price, and then they case-manage the patients who are on these drugs. So they have a personal relationship with these patients and their physicians, and we make decisions about if the physician would prefer for a patient to have medications in the office, then the meds are delivered to the office. Some of the new medications are so unstable that if you let them come to room temperature, and you know how you always shake the bottle up before you take something out of it? Well, if you let these medicines come to room temperature and shake the bottle, you'll destroy the entire vial. Those medicines we deliver to the doctor's offices. More typical things may go straight to the patient's home where they're self-administered by the patient. Then we formed our P&T committee, and our strategy around that was here in Salem. I'm sorry.
What's a P&T?
Pharmacy and Therapeutics.
We knew that.
We did. No.
Some of us knew that.
Excuse the jargon.
Pharmacy and Therapeutics.
It's the physician committee that usually makes the decisions on the formulary and which drugs we're using in various.
Our committee was created from the physicians in our community who were taking care of most of the OHP patients. And the breakdown is such that we have some clinics who really focus on this population of patients, and then we have some private offices who have very few. We specifically asked the physicians who, you know, the bulk of their practice was doing OHP, so when they decide that they're going to put a
prior authorization requirement on a medication, they impose that hassle factor upon themselves. And it, you know, every decision that's made that way, you know, I ask them, I say, do you want to put up with this hassle factor? And they'll say, how much money is it worth? And I'll say, that'll save us $5,000 a year. And I'll say, no. But for $250,000 a year, they're willing to put up with the hassle factor. That's one of the local relationships that we can have that we could never have from a big insurance company point of view, or even probably a statewide point of view, where those individual decisions are made. They differ a little bit from community to community, but we get the buy-in from the providers because it's their decisions. And when I get an angry doctor who wants to call me about a PA requirement, I say, go talk to Dr. So-and-so, who does nothing but take care of OHP patients, and ask him why he's willing to do this. We also took advantage of services from Dr. Lee Strandberg, who is the professor of community pharmaceutical socioeconomics at OSU's School of Pharmacy. And he has a great working knowledge of the day-to-day aspects of translating pharmacy policy from health plan down to pharmacy chains and on the way down to the individual pharmacist. And when we're making decisions, we often ask him for sort of a academic presentation, which is often very helpful. The last thing on that first slide there is simply that we have our own in-house data analysis. So we do get numerous reports from PCS, but we also constantly run those numbers ourselves to confirm them. The other thing that made PCS look good to us is they administer several Medicaid plans nationwide. So, for instance, when we first created the formulary, they were able to give us a draft of what is commonly done across the country, so we didn't really have to start by reinventing the entire wheel. We had something that we could throw out and bat back and forth. And they give us planning advice, for instance, with Representative Bates' question about why Actos and not Avandia. Those decisions usually come to us as Actos and Avandia. Is there any clinical evidence that one of these is better than the other? If not, is one significantly cheaper than the other? Maybe. So then you'd probably choose that. Or would one give you a better rebate than the other? And the rebate game, unfortunately, we have to play is very complicated. For instance, Actos may be a drug that is part of a rebate package from the manufacturer that includes five drugs. So they would say, if you want a rebate on Actos, you have to have four of our other drugs on your formulary. Those are the kinds of issues that a PBM really is useful for monitoring. They would take, several people full time to sit down and figure it out at our level. Even with their help, we sit there and the physicians on my P&T committee are aware that rebates are necessary, but they don't like them, and they will oftentimes simply choose not to play the game. And we've been able to do that and feel ethical and feel that we're doing right things and still stay within budget. PCS, all PBMs, I think part of their role is every month they give you reports on new medications that are coming out and their recommendations about whether they should be used or not.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
Tillman. I'm just curious about the remark you just made that sometimes people choose not to go for rebates. Can you explain why that would be?
There are people in the industry who feel that the rebate strategy is unethical, if you will.
And follow up, what is unethical about it?
Well, I don't agree with them, so I'm not quite sure what how to answer that, except they would liken it to a kickback. In fact, when I was at Providence, the Providence P&T committee, when I first got there, had chosen not to use rebates at all. They simply felt it was so unethical that they couldn't swallow that practice. A year went by, and the budget came back. And
their effort changed.
Yeah. We ended up with two PBMs at Providence. One managed the formulary, and the other was a PBM specifically hired because their expertise was in maximizing rebates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Hold on, Chris.
Just to clarify that, the rebates that come back go into the same chest of money, if you will, that's paying for the drugs to begin with. So it's really a strategy to reduce your overall drug expenses. It's not going in bonuses to participants in the plan or anything of that nature.
They sure don't go into bonuses?
Yeah. Okay. That's fine. I'll just make clear. Thanks.
Other categories of service. I mean, it's one of the things that plans can do. One of the issues we've got to wrestle with in the bulk purchasing is that shorten the rebates is short going to end up shortening some of the plans. That money just didn't go back into pharmaceutical purchases. I mean, it went into physician reimbursement. It went, you know, I mean, it helped run the organization. Mm-hmm. And maybe some pharmaceutical purchases as well. But I just wouldn't want you to characterize or think of it as simply pharmaceutical rebates going into pharmaceuticals. But not going into anyone's pocket.
Just to follow up on that, just very quickly, does the rebate come as a check or just come as a discount against the drugs purchased, against the bill?
The upfront drug cost, as you saw in Pat's presentation, we did, you know, it'll be AWP minus 14% or 13% or whatever you contract. As you approach a new year, the PBM people will give you an estimated rebate. So, for instance, if you choose to have Protonix on your formulary, is everyone familiar with Protonix for heartburn? Or if
we're
familiar
with that.
Yeah, you know Nexium, the little purple pill. Protonix is one of the competitors. So if you chose to have Protonix on your formulary instead of Nexium, and it was the only drug in that class on your formulary, the manufacturer might give you a 30 or 50% rebate on the cost of that medication beyond the 13% discount you got from AWP. Okay? So in the initial costing, there's an estimate for that figured in. And then a year goes by, you settle all the books. Usually the rebates are somewhat based on volume. And then there'll be a final reconciliation, you know, 6 months later. That kind of thing.
Mr. Bukovian.
Thank you, Chair. I know nationally there were some hearings a while back at the federal level about some of the larger PBMs. Getting actually rebates themselves, sharing some of the rebates with their consumers, but not wanting to basically say how much of the rebate they were getting themselves. I take it the PBMs that you operate probably operate on a similar basis. They secure some form of rebate. Are they open? Does that affect, do you think, the types of medications they might promote to you or are willing to negotiate kind of based on the amount of rebate they're getting as well? Now, how do you deal with that then?
If their income is based on a percentage of rebate, and it usually is, then you do have to watch them watch that they don't promote drugs that will give you more rebate and give them more income. Yeah, it's an issue.
It costs you.
It would cost. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'd just like to make a comment about that as well. One of the things that we negotiate with our PBM is the percentage of the rebate that they return to us versus the percentage of the rebate that they keep themselves, that they get from the manufacturer. And it used to be that they would give us 80% of the rebate. They'd keep 20%. We now get 90% of the rebate to put back into our medical budget.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So do I understand this correctly then? So the more drugs you use, the higher the rebate.
Yeah. Usually that's the way it works, yes.
The more drugs you use in the same company, but the fewer drugs you use per category.
Right.
You can look at it somewhat if they're promoting, as Dr. Kirk suggested, a more expensive drug. It's kind of like going and buying a new car and agreeing to paying $5,000 too much for it, and then you get a rebate. So you have to be careful as you manage your formulary to be sure that you're getting the most cost-effective drug and also maximize your rebate.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you ever audit your PBM?
We haven't.
We do not have a formal audit process. We have yet to figure out how to do that or who might do it from the way that you would audit your books. What we do is using AEL. We have them constantly.
Excuse us. Jeff Hetherington just received a phone call.
Stop the presses.
Emergency. Let's just stop while he takes that.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, before we go on, could I ask the speaker to use words instead of letters for those of us who are uninitiated in these
AEL
areas?
AEL is.
AEL.
Is AEL.
It's an organization.
Oh.
The Nautilus PBMs.
There we go again.
And I should probably know exactly what AEL stands for, but I will tell you honestly, I don't.
It stands for AEL as far as we're concerned.
Okay. How about PCS?
I think it's the name of the founders of the company, but I don't remember for sure.
I think it is.
Well, why don't you use AEL to audit your PBM?
Well, we do on an ongoing sort of ad hoc basis, but no one has yet come up with sort of a formal process to sit down and look at, you know, every line item, and quite frankly, because it would be difficult to know what the gold standard is to compare them to. We do have an ongoing issue with payments that they have approved to people whose eligibility wasn't valid, and we monitor that every month and go back and get reconciliation on that. We've had a half dozen cases where our physicians or committee members would, you know, call up and say, "Hey, the drug rep's here, and he tells me this drug's cheaper than the other one." They're usually not right, but we have had a couple of cases where we have discovered situations that gave us opportunities to get lower prices. When we call PCS and say, "Why aren't you giving us this low price?" And I've never had an explanation. I just get the answer that we'll be glad to match that price.
Representative Phil May wants to know what the PCS is.
Thank you.
PCS is our PBM. It's advanced.
It's like AEL.
Is that A-OK with you?
Or I should say Advanced Pharmacy Services. Advanced Pharmacy CS, I'm not sure what those last stand for, is our Pharmacy Benefit Manager.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz?
But, I mean, does AEL, you know, one of the things they say they do is they will check to make sure you're getting the best rebate possible. So that basically what you say, it's on an ad hoc basis, so every now and then they come in and check to make sure that you're asking the right questions of the pharmaceutical companies, that sort of thing, I'm assuming.
Now, when Advanced PCS gives us a recommendation,
right,
we ask AEL for their advice.
Okay. Have they saved you money?
Oh, yes.
Significant?
Yes. I, as a story, one of the opening gambits we had with Advanced PCS was that they had
check on Hetherington's phone call, make sure he's
they had agreed to make Prilosec their preferred drug for heartburn.
again, it's like Nexium. We were surprised about that because from previous experience, we knew the other medications were available for a lower price. And so we asked, and it was actually didn't take much investigation. It was quite transparent. The makers of Prilosec had settled with Advanced PCS for $5 million to have Prilosec as their drug of choice on the Advanced PCS national formulary. AEL informed us of that and said, if you'd like, we'll get you a contract for Protonix, which is the cheapest drug, outside of the formulary. We had specifically written the contracts to allow us to do that, and so we went ahead with the Protonix as our drug of choice. And so Advanced PCS, which is the largest PBM in the nation, has a national formulary, and all those formularies have Prilosec on them except for Mid-Valley IPA. Yeah.
And what's the difference in price?
I can't quote you off the top of my head. It's about $1 a pill.
Different?
Yeah.
Significant.
I think it's particularly significant, and if their formulary runs like ours, it's probably proton pump inhibitors, which Prilosec is one of, is probably the number one drug utilized in this population. It's our most costly drug.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you said they had settled for $5 million, is now you're talking about a rebate of which you would have gotten a share, or that's a payment that's completely independent of the rebates?
No, we wouldn't have seen a dime of that, $5 million. Hmm. We would have gotten a rebate on the Prilosec. Yeah. So these are the reasons that there are people who say the rebate game and the PBM business is very unethical.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certain that there are lots of opportunities for that business to be unethical, and it does require watchdogging. It's really impossible to do business without them, the way the world runs today. But you can't just turn them loose to go on their own.
If I can follow up, you mentioned the clause that you have to allow you to pursue a different drug outside of that PBM. List. Is that an unusual provision?
Yes.
And next time you negotiate, are they going to allow you to keep that? Are they a little worried that idea may spread? Are they going to allow you to continue to do that?
I don't know.
We'll keep us informed.
Yeah. Thank you.
Go ahead and continue.
Other things that we get from our PBM. One nice thing is that when a patient presents to the pharmacy, the pharmacist puts their medication into the computer, and it tells them right there on the spot whether it's on our formulary or whether it's not going to be covered. So it's a point of service feedback, and it stops things right there, as opposed to having some situation where they would give the patient the medication and then, you know, a week later have to say, oh, oops, I shouldn't have done that. So it's good for that feedback. It also, in our case management strategies, where there's prior authorization required, we can inform them at that point that there's prior authorization. We have some step therapy protocols. And what that means, if you're not familiar with that jargon, is that if you want Protonix, which is a very strong medication to control heartburn, one of our requirements is you have to have tried Zantac or Tagamet or one of the lesser medications that are now over the counter. So by having this built into the computer system, a physician might write a prescription for a Protonix. When the pharmacist puts that into the computer automatically looks to see if there were prescriptions filled for Zantac, and if so, it's approved automatically on the spot. If not, then we have to go back through the PA process, through the prior authorization process. We've also, in an effort to control that, unfortunately, there are a small number of people who do abuse their OHP benefits, and there are the drug seekers and narcotic seekers. When we identify them, we're able to lock them into one prescribing physician so that they can't go from ER to ER, doctor to doctor, and get multiple prescriptions, and they can only get their medications filled at one pharmacy so that the pharmacist gets to know them. And so this is also built into the computer. Should they, you know, go get another prescription for a narcotic at some ER on the coast or whichever gambit they want to play, they'll present to the pharmacy, and the computer will tell them that we're not going to pay for that. But we can't stop them from paying cash, but we do try to control that abuse that way. I think beyond that, you know, we've done the formulary creation. We've done the step therapy. We do have the mandatory generic policy. Advanced PCS tells us we have the highest generic utilization rate in their national book of business. We're about 75% generic utilization overall, realizing that there are some categories where there is not a generic available. And the categories where there is a generic available, we have 95% generic utilization.
Yes, Mr. Wacobian.
Do you use like pill splitting, higher dosages to split heads? Is that a common practice?
We don't have a formal policy on pill splitting. We have done an educational piece for our physicians to say, here are cost savings that you might want to consider for all your patients, probably more beneficial for the Medicare patient who has no pharmacy benefit at all. So we've made that an educational piece, but we don't have a mandatory pill splitting policy, no.
Do you, are there any kind of ballparks in terms of costs that can be saved in doing pill splitting? I mean, have you done any studies?
If we were to do a mandatory policy, we did look at that. It would. The opportunities are interesting. One of the big opportunities is in the medications to lower cholesterol, which happens to be our highest cost category at MVIPA. That would save us a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. And there are some other ones that are of lesser value and vary across the formulary all the way to Viagra.
Which isn't that your formula?
No, it's not.
There are some drugs, though, that don't present themselves well to the pill splitting.
That's very true. That's very true, and there's good literature about which medications those might be. We published a list of 11 that were basically listed in the pharmaceutical literature as being appropriate for, you know, the fact that if you had a 40 milligram pill and you got 45 milligrams one day and you know, 35 milligrams the next day, there'd be no clinical effect, wouldn't harm you. There are certainly some pills, you know, there are some pills that have a little line down the middle that could be easy to break in half, and then there are some that are capsules that you couldn't possibly split in half, and some that have other time-release mechanisms that would make them, you know, you couldn't split them in half. And so there's really, when you take into consideration all those factors and some of the apparent opportunities are actually in mental health drugs. You know, maybe splitting antidepressants would be something that's, you know, safe to do.
for the patient who's floridly psychotic, I doubt we'd be comfortable with that.
Okay. Continue.
I think I've covered pretty much everything here. I did give you the one slide, which is just a historical representation of our pharmacy costs. This number does include the drug cost and the dispensing cost and the rebate estimate, but not the final rebate reconciliations. And I would, again, echo, I'm sure, what's been said here before, that so much of the literature talks about rebates that are available and compares fee-for-service to managed care. But focusing on that number will lead you down the wrong garden path, and it's the bottom line PMPM, which comes as a result of generic utilization, prior authorization for clinical reasons, and managing to the line. Those strategies are the biggest savings of money. I think one of our interesting stories is about a year in operation, as things began to settle down, we had complaints from our members about the use patients using narcotics for below-the-line diagnoses, and so we took a look at that. We decided to remove the long-acting narcotics from the formulary, which meant that anybody who needed those medications would have to go through an exception process, which is basically the same as a prior authorization process. We were not surprised at the number of people we discovered who were getting chronic narcotics in huge doses or below-the-line diagnoses. And as things settled out, we realized a $20,000 a month savings from this. People sometimes ask how we managed to put this plan together so quickly and with sort of minimal pitfalls. And part of the reason was that we were there when the big health plans were trying to do this, and we saw what they weren't doing, and we tried to tell them to do it, but they didn't. And so, step one was, well, let's not make the mistakes that we knew they were making. And one of the mistakes was that they would not manage to the line. So it's a very important part of the cost containment.
Great, Peter. Representative Greenlee.
One of the possible ways to save money is to reduce utilization. I didn't hear you talking about that. I mean, we know the classic story of the geriatric patient with 12 medications. I'm not talking about geriatrics here, but there are other prescribing patterns that sometimes use very expensive drugs in a way that there's no rational reason for doing it. Did you do anything in your education and communications in trying to deal with unnecessary prescription of antibiotics, a variety of them?
We've not found an opportunity there yet. One of the great strategies that I'm a fan of is academic detailing, which is essentially hiring clinical pharmacists to go out and talk to physicians the same way that pharmaceutical representatives do.
It's not proven to be very effective when you really evaluate it.
Pardon me?
See, it hasn't proven to be too effective when you really evaluate it closely. It's a great idea, too.
It makes an impact. At Providence, it made an impact in sort of their closed system because they were working with employed physicians. But overall, it's difficult to do, especially in a community where your providers are as diverse as this one. The generic answer to your question would be no, we haven't.
If I can follow up. One way is to look at the prescription utilization rates by diagnosis by physician and look for outliers and have a chance to chat with them. Use your data system to give you that kind of.
Yeah.
we're not seeing any indications in our high-level data. We did just complete a study in conjunction with the CDC. In our review of emergency room cases, we were noticing that kids would come in with earaches, and there were two potential issues. One was they really wouldn't meet the diagnostic criteria for an ear infection, an otitis media. In spite of that, they would get an antibiotic.
There's the example.
The other issue was that sometimes, whether or not they met the criteria, sometimes that antibiotic would be an injection of Rocephin. It's an injectable antibiotic instead of a prescription for amoxicillin. So we're talking about $95 or $100 instead of $12.
And the wrong drug.
Yeah. We've submitted our data on that study to a CDC researcher and will be part of the Baker study.
Pat, did you want to add to that?
I just wanted to respond to Representative Greenlee, because we have done some of those sorts of things, and I wish our pharmacist was here to address them. But we have done some, as Dr. Kirk referred to them, clinical education or clinical detailing sessions with our physicians, and part of that was the involvement in the formulary development. The other piece was because of our Medicare population, many of whom do not have a drug benefit, because we were trying to facilitate our physicians finding cost-effective drugs for those folks, because either they couldn't afford to fill their scripts or they'd take them every other day or there were some other issues. So we began that process and then spread it across to our OHP population. And our pharmacist actually goes with physicians and does what we call brown bag sessions with our membership, where they put all their pills in a little brown bag and come, and we sit down and we gather information about what they're taking, who they got it from, because frequently their physicians don't know if they're doctor shopping. And then we collect that information and provide it back to their primary care physicians. And we found that to be a good tool for both the physician and the patient in terms of gathering information.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the incident that you were talking about, the physician giving the children the shots for ear infection, so how did you handle that then?
Well, we've not taken an intervention yet. Potential ways to handle that would be to do an educational process for the ER doctors, or you could get more punitive and focus on individual physicians and individual cases. We weren't able to really say that one physician was doing this a lot. It was sort of a smattering here and there, and so it was hard to focus.
Mm-hmm.
But we're waiting for the CDC to digest the data. We do have, at Salem Hospital, one of the ER physicians there sits on our board, and the medical director for Salem Hospital, who's a pediatrician, sits on the board for Marion Polk Community Health Plan. So we have excellent relationships there and ways to work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh.
Thank you. The incident you're talking about before, where the Viagra is not on the formulary, so if somebody came and actually needed Viagra, they could be prescribed that, but they would have to pay for it themselves. Is that correct?
That's correct. But it's only indication is below the line. It's non-funded, so yeah. But a physician could write that prescription, and they would pay for it themselves.
Thank you.
Mr. Wagobian.
Sure. Heck, you speak just kind of even generally about how the OHP formulary utilization costs such compared to some of your commercial product, same, different? Is there a lot of, I know they probably may vary depending on what the commercial company wants to pay, but is there some similarities there, or is there variance?
It's a little difficult to compare because the benefit package for a commercial product is obviously very different than the benefit package for the Oregon Health Plan. And as you alluded to, also an employer who generally chooses the benefits can choose a a different benefit package to cover different things. I think in general, if you just look at the data from the 50,000-foot view, you'll find that the cost per member per month in Medicaid is about double what we see in the commercial market. But also remember that the people in the commercial market usually have a copay and some other cost offsetting processes in their pharmacy benefit. So if they want a prescription, they have to pay a $10 or $15 or $20 copay, depending on what their package applies to, where currently the OHP folks, you know, in the plus population at least, don't have a copay. So the utilization is very, very different.
So would it be safe to assume that the people on Medicaid are probably older and so in more need of medication?
Medicare?
No. In our population that's in Medicare, that would definitely be the case. But in Medicaid, I think they're actually younger than the average population. I think our average age is in the mid-20s for our Medicaid population.
Really? Thank you.
So the point, I think your question is getting to why the higher utilization. Is it the no copay? Is it these people are needier, healthy? I mean, more medically needy? What would cause the difference between the OHP population and the commercial?
This is kind of an educated guess, and I'd look to Dr. Kirk to chime in. But I think what we see, number one, is the offsetting of the copay mechanism. You know, also, I think the population, the commercial population, is maybe more sophisticated in terms of asking for medications and asking about costs and before they go fill a prescription. I think also there is a more of a cultural, medically needy OHP kind of population mentality in terms of they're certainly more drug seekers. There's more interest in, I guess, the quick fix, for lack of a better term. And also there's a lot of noncompliance with medications where, you know, we sometimes repeatedly fill the same medication, an antibiotic, for example, for a child. So there's some issues there.
Okay, any further questions? Anything else for you folks to add?
Just as a summary, I think it's been said before, I'll say it again. I in trying to control the pharmacy costs, having worked from the ivory tower where I was in charge of five states, and now being blessed in Salem, I can tell you that the local organization and the local relationships make a world of difference, and it really does work.
I'd just like to reinforce what Dr. Kirk said earlier about, you know, focusing on only one portion of pharmacy costs, such as rebates, and also say that, you know, I too believe that, you know, the real cost savings is going to come from a cooperative management of patients' pharmacy costs and plans.
Well, thank you, and Chris, thank you very much, or Dr. Kirk, I should say. And Pat, I want to apologize for the sloven manners of a representative from Tumalo. He certainly doesn't know how to treat a member from his county, but we'll forgive him this time, if you will. All right, thanks very much. Adjourn the committee.